Hello and welcome to Next Week in Your Practice Session. In this session, Bill O'Hanlon joins Drs. Rick Hansen and Ruth Baczynski to give you concrete strategies you can use in your life and work with patients. Bill O'Hanlon is a licensed marriage and family therapist, inspirational speaker, and author of more than 35 books. Welcome to Next Week in Your Practice.
So, guys, welcome, and let's get into this webinar, and we'll start out with you, Bill. What stood out to you in the webinar with Dan Goleman?
This has been a major issue for me in my life, focus. As you know, because you know me personally, I can be a little distractible, a little impulsive, and a little all over the place. And I really have, that's been my major change, I think, in my life. I've learned to focus. I've learned to get things done that were harder for me. And I, you know, it's a strange thing. I learned to write books by going into my office and turning on excessively loud rock music so that I could create a bubble around myself so I could focus. And like what Dan Goleman said, after a while, I didn't have to use that. I developed my focus muscle. You know, I've written over 30 books now, so I can focus, and I don't need to do that loud rock music. But I had to work with my neurology, which was a distractible, and also, you know, the motivational piece you talked about. It was constantly looking for the new and exciting and motivational stuff. So I've calmed down over the years because I think these things are like muscles. You can train focus and attention. And I certainly learned that personally. So that's what stood out for me. It's such an important issue. I think it makes or breaks people in life, this ability to focus or not.
That's an interesting point, Bill. It makes or breaks people. Whether or not you have the ability to focus. Interesting idea. Rick, how about you? What stood out to you?
The basic idea that attention is the foundation of learning, which is essentially structure building in your brain. Attention being something like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner, illuminating what it rests upon, and then sucks it into your brain. And Dan really emphasized, obviously, the ways in which what we attend to is fundamentally important in terms of how we change ourselves for better or worse over time. And many people, unfortunately, you know, have difficulty keeping their attention, as Bill was talking about, on things that are useful, or alternately, pulling their attention away from those things that aren't so good. And one of the highlights for me from Dan's interview was his emphasis on training yourself, as Bill was talking about, so that you get more control over your personal vacuum cleaner that's continually sucking its contents into your brain.
Okay, Bill, so you've got a new idea there, thinking of attention as a vacuum cleaner, a spotlight and a vacuum cleaner. Interesting. So, Bill, staying with you, as expected, emotional distractions are the main reason for wavering concentration. What are your thoughts on ways that we can deal with different types of distractions?
Well, I've noticed with myself and with people with whom I work that any unfinished business just hangs around, sometimes in the back of your mind, taking little bits of your attentional ability, that learning ability, as Rick said. You're not going to learn as well. You're not going to be as available for everyday life if you have too many of those things. So whatever unfinished business you have, you know, in three ways that I, practical ways that I've used this. One is I really learned about forgiveness. There's a lot of books and a lot of methods about forgiveness. And I learned about that. And I had three really big resentments that I think I kept returning to a little at a time, and they were always in the back of my mind. When I forgave those people, it freed up a certain amount of attention available for other things, everyday life, the present. The second thing is writing lists. You know, I just write lists to get things out of my mind so I'm not thinking about it. Every once in a while, I would go back to the thing, oh, I should remember to do that. Just writing a list is a simple way to take some of that attentional, you know, drainage that was going on. And I think the third thing, and you know this because we're personal friends, I recently had a really hard conversation that I've been avoiding for 2 years. I just didn't want to deal with it. And every once in a while, it would rise up in my consciousness. And so I knew it was back there, stealing a little bit of my attentional ability and having a hard conversation. I had a little bit of guilt and a little bit of worry about it. And it must have been stealing some of that because I felt a little lighter and a little freer and a little more available for being present and learning and paying attention since I bit the bullet and had that hard conversation, which wasn't easy. I tend to be an avoidant kind of person. So I think it's a good thing. Think about what hard conversation you might need to have, what unfinished business, and get things out of your head on the paper, and then forgive. I think those are practical suggestions.
I like your ideas, and I think they all flow together there, the whole idea of forgiveness as a way to free up attention. But the other idea you made a point about is avoidance and how costly avoidance can be. We will be going into that, especially in the bonus series, that all of you who are listening today are gold subscribers, and so you'll be getting all of the bonus webinars. And we'll be focusing on avoidance and how costly that is. But you made a good point about it right there, Bill. So, Rick, switching ideas, what do you think about the finding that cognitive control is an independent factor in how well people do anything?
Right. It's really interesting, just to clarify the term, cognitive control has to do with regulating cognition, especially attention and the flow of thought. Additionally, of course, we need to regulate our emotions and our actions, our desires and our impulses and our behavior. All that kind of is under the heading generally of regulation. And the takeaway for me about all that is first to appreciate that we can grow, we can develop our regulatory capabilities, we can develop cognitive control. And second, that cognitive control is both top-down and bottom-up. There is a place for exercising top-down control, for giving oneself internal instructions, talking oneself off the ledge, you know, talking oneself through a difficult problem. There's research that shows, for example, if you teach children to talk out loud as they're going through a problem-solving activity, whether it's a math project or an art project, doesn't really matter, their performance goes up dramatically and they feel better about what they're doing. So that's more top-down control, and there's a place for that. On the other hand, sometimes people can go too far with sort of white-knuckling their way through life with too much top-down control. That was definitely my whole approach, you know, as this nerdy, dorky kid, you know, and young adult. I had to learn to relax top-down control. And then the other way to exercise cognitive control is an interesting one. It's more from the bottom up. In other words, by using top-down control to gradually motivate ourselves to incline toward a better place, a better direction, it becomes increasingly natural from the bottom up to just kind of increasingly move in that direction, to move from something that's deliberate to something that's more automatic. And I think it's helpful for a lot of people who may not be so strong at the top-down control to appreciate that they can plant seeds inside themselves by experiencing the rewards in their positive motivations. So increasingly, they're going to have a kind of natural cognitive control and inclination toward what's good for themselves without needing to be the boss inside their own mind about it.
Bill, back to you. The ability to cultivate concentration depends a lot on motivation. How do we motivate ourselves, and how do we help other people, the people we work with, be motivated to concentrate?
Yeah, you know, I had a friend who was an expert on ADHD kids, and he said, you know, everybody thinks ADHD is about attention. It's not about attention. It's about motivation. A kid who's motivated, who has ADHD, can focus really, really well. And I thought, that is true with me as well. If I'm interested in something, if I'm motivated for something. So I think that, you know, obviously find things you're interested in and that you're motivated for. But here's a point that I think isn't intuitively obvious for people. I wrote I've written a bunch of books, as you mentioned in the introduction. I'm over 30 books. And the way, I'm not a natural writer. It wasn't easy for me to sit down at the keyboard and compose. It was hard for me, but I had a strong motivation. And the motivation wasn't a positive one, actually. I had a little positive motivation. I wanted to contribute to people, but I had more of a negative one. I was frankly upset about the state of my field, my chosen field, which was psychotherapy. I thought that people were doing things wrong and I wanted to correct them. So that I had a negative motivation, but it was a strong motivation, but I turned it into a positive by making it into a contribution. And if I just shown up at the mental health center with the AK-47, that's a negative way to express that motivation. That's an angry way to express it. And I was angry, but I turned it into a positive contribution. So I think finding something that you're really motivated, even if it's a negative motivation, and then change it to overcome, for me, my natural flakiness, disorganization, impulsiveness, inability to concentrate very easily, that I use that emotional motivation to change my attentional habits. And now, as I said, I don't have to get so angry. I don't have to listen to loud rock music, as I mentioned earlier, to write or to make these kind of contributions. So it's a muscle that can be trained, but you need to have that energy to be willing to train the muscle.
Rick, Dan pointed out, one of the things that he pointed out is that we can't always decide when we're going to get interrupted. And many times we can, but we can't always. How do we cut through that necessity to always be on, to always be available at any distraction? How do we train ourselves and perhaps our context to change some of that?
Yeah. For me, it was a powerful idea to realize that attention, in some ways, is our most fundamental property. It's our personal property. And to not presume that other people can just take our property, and also to be careful about taking the property of others, interrupting them, for example, or simply presuming that they're going to give us their attention. So that's the first thought. The second one is, if you are going to take more control over where your attention is allocated, where it's resting, you've got to be, as Bill said, motivated to do that. You have to feel entitled to claim your own attention, and that you have the right, actually, in appropriate ways, to put up boundaries so that you can create a kind of sanctuary for where you want to put your attention and what you want to grow there. It's a little bit like if you're going to grow a garden and you want to have flowers there. If you can't put a little fence around it and protect this plot of land, you can't grow anything good there. So then, to make it concrete, a few things come to mind. One is to actually carve out a time in your day, if only a few minutes, hopefully 15 or 20 minutes or more, where you can kind of gather yourself. People do that in different ways. Some people formally meditate. Others will use the time walking their dog, speaking of pets, or a certain specific time every day where they just have a cup of tea and they look out the window and they kind of come home to themselves. That's an important thing to do every day that'll be centering. Another is, when you're doing something, let yourself complete it before you shift on to the next thing. Very often people will be in the middle of doing some activity, you know, literally wiping a dish down or finishing an email or handling some particular thing with somebody else. Then an interruption will come along, a claim on their attention, and at that point you're at a crossroads. Do you drop what you're currently doing, or do you take the 30 or 60 seconds to complete it and let it come to a natural end? And I think it's okay, unless it's obviously an emergency, to say, just a second, I'm going to finish this, and then I can naturally shift my attention over to you. But if we don't take charge of doing that, man, oh man, oh man, I mean, the greatest minds of our generation are devising ever more fiendish and devious ways to grab our attention, whether you're walking through a mall or, you know, just at the supermarket and the checkout stand, all the things that are trying to grab your attention, and let alone in daily life. And I think if we don't stand up for the property of our own attention, other people are going to be taking it away from us.
I have just an additional practical one that I learned a little while ago. It's been really helpful for me. It's called the Dr. Pepper email pattern. Now, why is it called the Dr. Pepper email pattern? When I was growing up, the Dr. Pepper little sodas that we have in the United States have, they had a recommendation, you drink it at 10, 2, and 4. That was their marketing technique. Well, I learned this technique. You train people that are in your life. I'm not going to respond to email, you know, just every time you write me, because if somebody writes you and you don't write back in 2 minutes, they say, "Where are you?" What, you know? And so you say, "I'm going to respond at 10, 2, and 4. And I'll just batch those activities and don't expect an instant response from me otherwise." And I brought mine down to 4 o'clock every day. It's like just once a day. But I had to train people in my life not to intrude upon my attention because I had other things I wanted to do.
Yeah. Rick, for people who are more right brain oriented, what are some ways to balance left and right brain?
Yeah, that makes me think actually about Einstein's comment. he said the easy part was figuring out relativity because he could visualize it. The hard part was moving out of the right brain, as it were, the right hemisphere, which is more visual, spatial, and gestalt in its processing. And the hard part for him was going into the left brain approach, which was the language that's sequential, because that's what the left hemisphere does, particularly the sequential language of mathematics. That was a difficulty for him. And I figured, well, if Einstein had that problem, you know, there's hope for the rest of us. And I guess my takeaway from that is to appreciate that for many people in this language-saturated culture that we have, they're more right hemisphere-oriented. They're more nonverbal in their processing, and they're equally intelligent. It's just a different collection of skills and aptitudes. So as a piece of that, I think respecting yourself for being a right-brain person in a pretty left-brain world is an important place to start. And also, if you do want to create more balance, though, I can think of a couple things that are quite concrete. One is to do more of a noting practice, where you simply use language to name what's happening in a neutral kind of way. For example, breathing, you know, a little soft word in the back of your mind, breathing, or focusing, like Bill was talking about earlier, or worry, or happiness. Just that actual process of bringing a little bit of language to your own experience will help ground you in the benefits of inner language. And as research shows, it'll increase more activity in your prefrontal cortex and calm down the amygdala, the alarm bell of the brain. The other thing is that if you're more of a right brain person and you still need to do planning and organizing, use visual or concrete ways of doing that. For example, if you're trying to figure out a project, you know, use some 3x5 cards for the different parts of the project, lay them out on your desk so you can see which comes first and which comes second, or what has to be done to set yourself up in a good way, you know, for steps 4 and 5. That way you're bringing the strengths of your right hemisphere to a more left brain activity and creating more of a sense of integration that, therefore.
One last question, Bill. One of the things that I asked every speaker was what we'll be looking at from a brain point of view in the next few years. It didn't always make it the cut in the webinar, but it was interesting, Dan Goleman's prediction, that we'll be looking at epigenetics. Then that will be capturing our attention and so forth. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's one of them, but I think there's a broader perspective on where we're going into the future, and I think each of your brain series has had this in it, and I'm so excited about it. Carol Dweck, educational researcher, has talked about the growth mindset or the fixed mindset in kids. If they say, "Oh, I'm not good at math," or "I'm good at math," but that's a fixed mindset. If they say, "I'm not so good at math, therefore I better work at it because it's a muscle I need to train, it's an ability that I could work at," they do better long-term in school. Those kids, it doesn't matter about their native intelligence, their willingness to learn and to grow. And I think as a field, we've had a fixed mindset for a century or so. In the last 20 or 30 years, and in part due to your brain series, we're spreading the word. There's a new way to think about genetics, epigenetics. That is, the genetics are fairly fixed, but epigenetics, the expression of genes, they're not so fixed. They're more plastic and changeable. The brain and the neurology, your muscles are more, you know, changeable than we used to think. that we used to think people, elderly people, couldn't gain muscle mass. Now we know they can. So we're getting into this whole idea of possibilities. It's a growth mindset and a possibility mindset rather than a fixed mindset. And that, for me, is the takeaway from all your series, number one, that to get grand about it. And this particular conversation that you have with Dan Goleman, it's so exciting. There are possibilities. If we don't take advantage of those possibilities, they don't become realizations. So there, it's not automatic that these possibilities become actualities. That, for me, is the exciting stuff that's growing and changing in the future. And we're getting the evidence for this, the scientific evidence for this.
Thank you for watching this session. We hope you'll go ahead and take these ideas and begin using them in your work. In part four, you'll find your quick start guide. It's an at-a-glance reference to the most critical concepts and practices from this short course. You'll be able to use this to refresh your memory so you'll feel confident in turning these insights into action. And in part five, you'll find the transcripts. You'll be able to download, print, and refer to these professionally formatted transcripts as often as you like. Thanks again for watching.